taking you to the threshold of a dream and beyond. Seventh Wave Network.
Hello, and welcome to Spirit of Film Conversations. I'm your host, Randall Libero. Movies are changing the way we think, live, and dream. So each week, we showcase today's independent and visionary filmmakers whose movies evoke what I call the spirit of film, which is a metaphor for the movie's magical power to transform our lives. And today we're going to talk about a film called Jesus, The Lost Years, just released on DVD. It's a film that explores the very real history behind those passages in the Bible that don't explain what Jesus did as a child and his time spent in Egypt with his family. This is an inspiring voyage that combines adventure, spiritual journey, and historical detective work. Was Jesus' childhood actually spent in Egypt? And if so, what did he do there? Where did he go? And is there any proof? And my guest today is best-selling author and writer-producer of the film, Paul Perry. Paul, welcome to the show.
Randall, thank you for having me.
Well, my first question is, on a personal level, since I always ask questions of the filmmaker, what personally led you to start to explore the mystery of Jesus' early life in Egypt?
Well, it's kind of an odd story, and it shows you how, I think, how obsessions start and just get a hold of us. I was in Egypt about 10 years ago, and I was working on a documentary film called Stone Temples of the Nile. And the gist of the film was, it was a documentary, and we started way up by the Sudan, and we had a filming boat, and we were going from one stone temple along the Nile after another. And we had flown there all night. It's a 21-hour flight to Egypt, and then it's, you know, 6 or 8 more hours to get to Luxor. And I was sitting on the front of the boat, kind of thinking of nothing in particular, and all of a sudden across the desert I saw 3 Bedouins on camels, and they were dressed in white, and it was very picturesque. Their robes were flowing, and the 3 of them were just going across the desert, which was right up against the Nile. And suddenly, for no particular reason, it popped into my mind that Jesus had been to Egypt. The book clearly tells us that. But then there are no stories about what he did while he was in Egypt. And I think seeing these 3 Bedouins reminded me of the 3 wise men. And I know that Jesus went there right after, pretty much after his birth. So I started asking questions around Egypt. I started asking questions at the next temple we stopped at, which was a temple called Edfu. Do you know any stories about Jesus? And I asked this of everybody I ran into, whether they were Christian or Muslim. And lo and behold, they started telling me story after story about Jesus in Egypt. None of these stories were in the Bible. And I started to collect these stories, and they very willingly put story to place for me. They told me where these stories occurred. And I realized that there was a huge body of oral tradition about Jesus that really hadn't been recorded. So I started collecting these stories. When I came back to the United States, I continued to collect stories about Jesus in Egypt. And then I found that the Coptic Orthodox Church, which is among the oldest Christian churches in the world, was hundreds of years ahead of me. They had collected all the stories already and put story to place, and had even been so bold as to come up with a trail that they called the Holy Family Trail in Egypt. And it became an obsession for me to follow that entire trail, which is a trail that runs from Israel, zigzags through the Fertile Crescent in Egypt, and then goes down below Cairo about 300 miles into an area called Fundy Land, which is where many of the fundamentalists who were with Osama bin Laden came from. And it became an obsession for me to follow that. So that's the short version of how I came to be interested in this subject.
Well, in the movie you had mentioned that some of the people that you met actually took you into several of the churches and temples there, and actually showed you, and we see this in the film, some books that have artwork, some very old texts that they have. What were some of the information that they actually had written down beforehand that you had the ability to take a look at and have them go through? And you got some of that on film.
I did, yeah. I got a lot of that.
Talk a little bit about what those texts actually were, what they were making reference to, and what they contained.
Well, let me back way up then and
okay.
talk about the Coptic Church a little bit.
Right.
The Coptic Church was founded in about 60 by the Apostle Mark, and he came to Alexandria and he founded the church there. And the language, the Coptic language, Coptic means Egyptian. So when you talk about the Coptic Church, you're talking about the Egyptian Christian Orthodox Church. The language they use is Copt, and it's written different. It's written with the Greek alphabet plus 6 extra characters. And it's the oldest existing written language in Egypt. It's believed to be derived from the Pharaonic languages, the hieroglyphs that we see. And that makes these stories very old, and in my book, very valid. And obviously in the Coptic Orthodox Church's book, very valid. And what they've done is they have collected these stories, and these stories were written down hundreds of years ago in these incredible, ornate, illuminated manuscripts. They were written down, and they're kept now in monasteries throughout the country. They're kept by the monks, and they're very precious documents. And I had actually thought, I wanted to see the stories. And I had actually thought that for a while we would have difficulty seeing them because I was afraid they wouldn't allow us to come into the archives and actually film it. But it was quite the opposite. They were very gracious about letting us come into their libraries and their archives and film things and read stories to us and explain how these stories had been handed down.
I want to backtrack a little bit so our listeners have some perspective. And by the way, if you are listening out there and would like to comment or ask a question of Paul Perry, you can call our listener line. It's 1-866-472-5795. Again, 866-472-5795. When the Holy Family fled from King Herod, as described in the Bible, at this time, how old was Jesus when he was in Egypt? What years did he spend there, and did he attend things like school, like other children, or what exactly happened?
Yeah, it isn't really clear exactly how old he was when he went there. But the assumption is, from certain dates and things, is that he was 2 years old when he left Israel and fled to Egypt. And if you do the math in the Bible, you can pretty much deduce that he was there until he was about 7.5 years old. So he spent roughly 5.5, 6 years in Egypt. Much of this time, the Holy Family was on the lam. They were running from the soldiers of King Herod, because as you'll recall from the Bible, King Herod sent soldiers to pursue the Holy Family. And so much of the story is a chase story. And then it becomes, for some reason, it's not really clear from the stories, the soldiers appear to quit following the Holy Family. And after that, the Holy Family is able to settle down. Once they get down below what is now Cairo, they're able to settle down and live a little more normally. And at that point, it looks as though they tried to enroll Jesus in school. But according to the stories, he was too smart. On his first day in one of the schools that they enrolled him in, probably in a place that's now called Oxyrhynchus, the headmaster of the school turned him away after the first day and said, this boy knows more than I do. He doesn't need to be here. And that's about just about the only mention you get of Jesus having been in school when he was in Egypt.
Was there anything that you found as far as the Holy Family and Jesus himself visiting the Sphinx and the pyramids?
Oh, yeah, I think they would have had to have seen the Sphinx and the pyramids because they the trail takes them right past that area. And in that particular day, it's very interesting. The pyramids and the Sphinx were as old to the Holy Family as the Holy Family is to us. The pyramids were built at least 2,000 years before the Holy Family came through there. And, of course, the Holy Family went through there about 2,000 years ago right now. So what they were seeing was a very, very old structures that were very, very well known. Because the pyramids were the largest human-made structures in the world at that time. And I've often wondered what they must have thought when they saw the pyramids. I mean, I personally doubt that Jesus was repelled by them. I'm sure, like anyone who sees them, he was amazed. He probably thought it was a joke that, you know, the essential purpose of the pyramid is to in some ways propel a pharaoh to heaven. I'm sure he thought of that as being kind of a joke, but it must have been incredibly impressive for the Holy Family to see these structures. Other things weren't so impressive for Jesus, though, by the way, Randall. According to the Egyptian oral tradition and written tradition, he destroyed a lot of the temples that he saw. He was offended by a religion that worshipped stone idols. And he apparently destroyed many of the temples in the country. And in fact, every temple above the line where he eventually reached, which is an area called a suit, every temple above that line, which means the Holy Family passed through, all of them were destroyed, and remain so to this day. They're all destroyed temples, and many of them, no one can explain why they were destroyed. And by no one, I mean no archaeologist from any country can explain why they were destroyed. Yet below that line, which is where you get into the really magnificent structures you see all the time on Discovery Channel, and Luxor and places like that, those still exist. They weren't knocked down. Now, Egyptian Christians, as well as Muslims, because Muslims, although they don't believe Jesus was divine, they certainly believe he was a prophet. Many of them believe that Jesus, on his way down to that area in a suit, destroyed every temple that he passed, because he was trying to introduce a new religion to people, a religion that didn't involve idolatry. And we visited a particularly neat area that you can see on the film in an area called Tel Basta, which is, if you look at a map, Egypt looks extraordinarily, it just looks like desert, but right up at the top of Egypt, it's almost like a cone-shaped area. That's the verdant delta, they call it. And right on the edge of that is this area called Tel Basta that used to be a square mile of temples dedicated to the cat goddess Bastet. And twice a year, Egyptians would come from all over the country to have these festivals of alcohol and sex. It was kind of like a Woodstock for ancient Egyptians. According to the stories, the Holy Family went there. They were not greeted very well by the locals, and they would not give Mary any water. So Jesus decided to get rid of the whole temple complex. And with his mind, as they put it in their stories, he destroyed all of the temples. He knocked them all over. And then in the middle of all the temples, he built a well that gave Mary water. When you go to that site now, what you see is literally a field, a square mile of fallen idols. And in the middle of it is a certified first century well that Muslim archaeologists believe was actually created by Jesus. And it's been a subject of a lot of dispute in Egypt because German archaeologists come there, American, and no one can tell why this whole field of idols collapsed. And because of that, and because of the stories that back it up, Muslim archaeologists have said, well, this is proof that Jesus was actually here and actually destroyed these idols. It's pretty astounding.
Well, you traveled with an internationally recognized historical researcher, John DeBry.
Right.
And just so everyone knows who's listening, he's the founder and director of the Center for Historical Archaeology. And he's also a paleographer and a document manuscript specialist, and he's been featured as a consultant to a lot of shows that have been on the Discovery Channel, National Geographic, Nova, on PBS, and so forth. So as you were traveling and found these sites, and these are sites that you, some of them you show in the film, so we could actually go into this place that you mentioned, like Jesus' the well, and actually go to that place. It's actually a real place.
Actually, yeah, it's right there. You can walk right to it.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Well, we talked about this with the Coptic Pope, who's a really great guy. He's about 80 plus years old, named Pope Shenouda III. And what he really wanted me to emphasize more than anything is that Egypt represents an undiscovered holy land. That to Middle Eastern Christians, it's almost as important as Jerusalem is to Christians worldwide, because it shows so much of what Jesus was about as a child. Yeah, it's amazing. You can go to all of these sites now, and I mean, I'm talking about 500-600 miles worth of sites. I mean, it took me 2 months to cover it when I wrote a book, and then it took me another 2 months when I went back and made the film. And it's just one extraordinary site after another.
Well, knowing about ancient Egypt and the whole very long legacy of mystery and spiritual worship that they were involved in, which resulted in some amazing, remains all over the Giza Plateau and many other places. When Jesus saw this, what do you think were some of the possible influences on him from the Egyptian, not just religion, but just looking at some of these things? Do you think that he was able to tune in to some of the mystical forces that so many people talk about that are around some of these sites, and what do you think that, if anything, that he learned from that?
That's an interesting question and a dicey one to get into. So let me get into it.
Okay.
There are people who believe that, and these are, Morton Smith is one of the fellows' names. Morton Smith is an archaeologist and a theologian at Columbia University. He believes that Jesus learned much of what he learned magic tricks. That's how Morton Smith puts it. And he considers Jesus to have been a magician. And he feels that he learned these from the priests in Egypt. And that would include the ability to turn water to wine, the ability to heal certain illnesses, or to recognize when someone has a hysterical illness and how to deal with a hysterical illness instead of a physical illness.
That, by the way, is documented in many other writings that I've looked at about his ability to understand illness by looking at someone.
Yes.
So that's I've seen that noted before. Go ahead.
He has even gone so far as to say that Jesus had tattoos. And these tattoos contain magical formulas that he had put on his arms so he wouldn't forget what the formulas were. And they were written in hieroglyphs. Be that as it may, the other side of the story says that Jesus actually went to Memphis. There's one story where I'm talking about Memphis, Egypt, by the way, not Memphis, Tennessee. But there was one story where Jesus and his mother, his parents were in a town, and one of the priests had a son who was mad. He was probably schizophrenic, and he was kind of considered the raving lunatic of the neighborhood. And Jesus, and according to the story, Jesus took one of his own wet diapers and placed the diaper on this boy's head and healed his madness. And when the priest saw that, he was very impressed, and he brought the Holy Family into the court in Memphis, Egypt, into the court of priests. And the story ends there, but the story ends there with a very puzzling sentence. And the sentence is, and while he was there, Jesus was able to learn all the mystery and the healing that the Egyptian priests could show him. Coptic Christians, though, believe that he probably did go into a situation where he was introduced to a number of priests and spent a lot of time with them, but that he taught them more than they were able to teach him.
So it's possible that Jesus taught the Egyptians about healing and spirituality.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they're saying. I would think that's entirely possible.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you see it now with traditional physicians coming from other countries and teaching American doctors traditional medicine and vice versa. So there's really no reason to believe that Jesus, who was the great healer, could teach the great healers of Egypt something, and vice versa. I'm fairly open about this. A lot of people wouldn't be open about it.
Talk a little bit about some of the things that were in your book that were not covered in the film. That so you know you had more time to go into detail in the book.
I had more time to explain the origin of many of the stories about Jesus, and eventually what happened to these stories and how they influenced other religions. Let me give you an example.
Yeah, you're talking about the oral tradition now.
The oral tradition. Oral tradition is kind of an interesting thing, and I think oral tradition gets sort of a bad rap, to tell you the truth. It's important to remember that in those days, the days of Jesus, very few people could write. Very few people could read. And the only way of passing information from one person to the next was orally. That would be everything from a shopping list to something as important as what Jesus had to say. And to carry it even further, the notion of oral tradition in this country always equates oral tradition to the thing they call the telephone game. Do you remember that? Where you sit in a big circle, and one person tells a story and whispers it to the next person, and the next person whispers it to the next, and the next, and the next. And by the time it gets around the circle, the story has changed significantly. Middle Eastern Christians don't believe that's what oral tradition is all about. They say in their tradition, a priest will convey a story to an entire congregation. Let's use that as an example. And the entire congregation, it might be 100 people, they all hear the story the way the priest told it. And when they leave the church, they tell that story the way the priest told it. And if they vary from the way the priest told it, other people who heard it jump in and correct them. So they feel that there's a kind of a self-correcting mechanism to oral tradition. And that because of that, it can be handed down for hundreds of years in the same way that it was originally told. And they point to their own hymns as being an example of this. Because hymns in the Coptic Church, and they have as many hymns as Baptists do, hymns in the Coptic Church were passed on orally for hundreds of years, and were not written down until the beginning of the 20th century. And the feeling among academics is that they were all written down as they were originally written because their rhyme schemes are all very pure. So that's the issue about oral tradition. Their belief is, and I think Christians' belief as well, if they really thought about it, is that oral tradition bounces around for a while, then it gets written down, and it becomes gospel. Because that's exactly what happened with our own Bible. The New Testament was written in the order of Mark, Matthew, Luke, John. And Mark was the first book. That was written at least 30 years after the crucifixion. So that means that it was written from an accumulation of 30 years of oral tradition. John was written about 110 years after the crucifixion. So that means it was written from 110 years worth of oral tradition. So we have oral tradition in the West as well. We just don't think of it as being that way.
I'm going to throw kind of a curveball question at you. Do you think that possibly any of the Gospels who was said to have written the Gospels, or the disciples, or Mark, Matthew, Luke, John, do you think that they actually went to Egypt to research some of his early life, or at least kind of get a flavor of something, or do you have any evidence to that effect?
Well, I've never been asked that question. Can you believe it? But without question, Mark went to Egypt because that's where he was eventually killed. In 61, he was killed by angry crowds in Alexandria.
Well, that's good evidence.
Yeah. But he was there. Obviously he did. And obviously he heard stories about Jesus being in Egypt.
Possibly related by Jesus himself.
Absolutely.
All right. Until you just said that, that thought never occurred to me.
It never occurred to me either. I mean, maybe I'll go back and start researching it from that point of view.
Yeah, that'd be a little good follow-up there.
Yeah.
Well, here's a question that talking about evidence of things that people would remember. Did Jesus? Is there any evidence that Jesus performed miracles while he was in Egypt?
Oh yeah, there's many, many miracles that he performed in Egypt. Yeah, absolutely. Should we get to that after the break?
Yeah, why don't we do that? And I also want to cover some of the other parts of the movie that are specifically not about Jesus himself, like the apparitions of Mary at one of the churches in Egypt. You talk about that, show that in the film for a while, and also you had a vision that you experienced too, and I want to cover a little bit of that while you were there. Either I don't know whether it was during the book or the film, but at some point. Well, anyway, we're going to take a break right now, everybody, and come back with more about Jesus, the Lost Years, with writer-producer Paul Perry right after this break. So stay tuned. There's lots more to tell, a lot more exciting history and mystery to explore right here in Spirit of Film Conversations. We'll be right back right after this break.
Awakened Media for a transforming world. Seventh Wave Network.
Dad, can I ask you something?
Sure.
There's this girl I kind of like.
Say no more.
You just have to impress her. Okay, but how?
Just, I don't know, pick up a lot of heavy things around her.
Like what?
You know, desks, chairs, people. Grunt if you have to.
Grunt?
Yeah, be like, there you go.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. When you adopt a child from foster care, just being there makes all the difference. To learn more, call 1-888-200-4005. A public service announcement brought to you by Adopt U.S. Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
The last great frontier is the magnificent mystery of the mind. Abundant evidence demonstrates that we have far more talents than we realize, and that our minds are exceptional instruments we can learn to use more fully, just as we'd learn to play a piano or a clarinet. Tune in to The Music of Your Mind, Living the Extraordinary, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on the 7th Wave Network, and learn more about how you can hear the wonderful music of your mind.
Create a life with growth, balance, abundant peace of mind, and joy. Tune in and call into Spirits Evolving with pragmatic psychic and certified hypnotherapist, Lee Channing. By using the simple tools for growth offered by Lee, including intuition, color awareness, creative visualization, and more, build a stronger understanding of your own energy and offer clear, unencumbered energy to those with whom you share your life. Whether for an individual or a business, home environment, or your office. Lee evaluates and interacts with the energy at hand, providing an analysis of the problem and a description of the options available to move forward successfully and with grace. Spirits Evolving with Lee Channing broadcasts each Friday at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, on the Seventh Wave Network, your online community for positive change. Spirits Evolving, your guide toward a life filled with more balance, intention, and contentment.
Reiki, balancing form and essence. Hosted by Reiki Master Phyllis Lee Furumoto, brings to the Seventh Wave Network this worldwide human art form. Join Phyllis every Thursday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time as she shares her experiences from around the globe and helps you understand the effects of living in conscious relationship with the energy of Reiki. Reiki, balancing form and essence. Every Thursday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time on the Seventh Wave Network.
Taking you to the threshold of a dream and beyond. Seventh Wave Network.
Well, hello everyone. We're back here with Spirit of Film Conversations. I'm your host, Randall Libero. Today we're talking about an amazing film that's just released on DVD, Jesus, The Lost Years. And you can go to a website to check out more about the movie. It's JesusInEgypt.com. Again, JesusInEgypt.com. And we're here with best-selling author and writer-producer Paul Perry. Paul, welcome back.
Hey, thank you very much, Randall.
And if you want to comment on our conversation, you can call in. We are live right now here on Wednesday. It's 1-866-472-5795. Again, 866-472-5795. Before we went to break, we were talking about a couple of things that I wanted to make sure that we fit into the conversation today. And the first half of the show, we were talking a lot about Jesus and the historical evidence behind his years in the area. But another part of your film covers actually apparitions of the Virgin Mary at one of the churches in Egypt. Can you talk a little bit about that part of the film?
Yes, Egypt has more apparitions than any place I've ever heard of, and we know nothing about them here in the U.S. Perhaps the most interesting one I've ever heard took place at a church called Zaytun, and it's a suburb of Cairo. It's a beautiful little church. It looks like a jewel box. And 40 years ago, next April, two Muslim garage attendants were standing across the street attending a government garage for a building there. And they looked up on the dome of this church, and they saw a woman on the dome, and they thought it was a young woman who was trying to commit suicide. So they ran out into the streets, and they yelled for her to be careful and get down. And then they realized they could see through her. And they ran into the church and got the priest. The priest came out and he said, "Oh my God, Mary has returned." And what he was referring to was that, according to oral tradition, the Holy Family passed through this area in Zaytun. And Mary was exhausted from the heat and the long trip. And she had to sit down in the spot where the church was, and she was ready to give up. Just give in and let the Roman soldiers take her. And Jesus said, "No, get up, keep going. And if you do that, churches all over the country, all over this country, will be named after you." So a very wealthy man had a vision, and he built that church. And his vision, he wrote his vision down and put it into the altar. And what that says is that 40 years from now, after this church is built, Mary will come back again. So this was now 40 years later from the date the church was built. And here she was on the roof. Now, this was...
And this was like 1968?
1968, April of 1968.
That's amazing. So that's very recent.
Well, but it's, yes, but it goes on. It wasn't a fleeting vision. She came back several times for the next year. And it got to the point where there were tens of thousands of Egyptians jamming the streets in this particular area of town. And it was in the newspaper constantly. There were photos. It was in the newspaper constantly. And finally, President Nasser, who, you know, as you know, is a very staunch Muslim, said, I have to go see this. So he snuck into the garage with his security forces and sat there all night and watched her. And after that, he was so impressed that he more or less said, don't give Coptic Christians any more trouble in this country. And I'm donating all of this land to them, all the land surrounding the Church of Zaytun. But I've interviewed many, many people. In fact, I have had plans for a long time to go back and make a documentary just about this event because it's so extraordinary.
And if people want to see photos of this, how you spell this, so you can do a search on it. It's Zeitoun.
Yeah, or
right.
You can go to JesusInEgypt.com.
Uh-huh.
There's a slideshow, and that particular photo, one of those photos is in that slideshow.
Okay, great.
Yeah, it's very impressive. And literally, tens of thousands of people saw this. And people at all levels of the government, at all education levels, and from many different countries. I've interviewed, last Christmas, I interviewed an FDA scientist, an MD, PhD from the United States, who had seen it. And I met him in Egypt. He actually went up to the dome, and I have this on film. He talked about what he saw and how she manifested herself night after night. And she would literally, it was like a holographic image, but of course, they had holograms then, but there's no way you could transport one around or put one in Egypt. And Egypt wasn't exactly Western friendly at the time anyway. But, you know, she would kind of come off the roof and sometimes float down in front of people. And people would describe her the same as everyone else would just, everyone would describe her the same way. You know, they could see her teeth. It looked as though she was looking right through them. And the amazing thing was, is that I interviewed a Harvard theologian named Otto Meinardis. And Otto had been there as a professor at American University in Cairo. And he would bring his students, Western students and Egyptian students, to the church night after night. He'd have five or six students there. Sometimes four of them would see the vision and one or two wouldn't. And he said it had no relationship to how devout they were or anything else. He couldn't figure out why. But sometimes people couldn't see her, even though everyone else could see her.
Don't you just love stuff like that?
You know,
it just baffles the mind when people say things like that. Well, okay, well, everybody else can see her, but this person can't.
Yeah.
I mean, you've seen that in movies, you know, like in Field of Dreams when the Ray's brother can't see the baseball field.
It was absolutely amazing because this particular vision changed the politics of Egypt. President Nasser was right in the middle of kicking out everybody but Muslims. And he had pretty much gotten rid of all the Jews in Cairo. Greek Orthodox gave up, and they left and gave their churches to the Coptic Church. And Copts were struggling to stay there. And as soon as this happened, Nasser completely changed. So it's considered by Egyptian Christians to be the most important Christian event since the resurrection. And I will bet that none of your listeners have ever heard of it.
Yeah, well, definitely there's going to be some people doing searches, going to JesusInEgypt.com and,
yes,
and checking out the photos of it. And just so everyone knows, I had one of my relatives, and she's no longer alive, but she traveled to all the places in the world. She was a devout Roman Catholic. All the places in the world that had visions or apparitions of where Mary actually manifested. So Egypt was one. Garibaldi, Spain was another. And those places, I think, in France. And, you know, so this is not the only time that this has happened. I just want to get that across to our listeners.
Oh, yeah. Did she? And what did she say? Did she see visions herself?
Well, she talked with people, and she even brought back a VHS, a videotape, which I still have, of children, and this was back, I think, in the early 70s when this happened in Garibaldi, Spain. And you can watch the children, and they actually filmed when the children were, there were about three or four of them, both girls and boys, that were actually, at the moment of the filming, they were seeing Mary, seeing the vision. And you can see flash bulbs going off. And the really cool thing is on this video is that their eyes don't blink even though the flash bulbs are going off right in their faces.
Wow.
So it's really amazing, you know, to see these children. They're in ecstasy. Excuse me. They're in ecstasy. So I mean, their eyes are not, you know, they're sort of tuned into another reality beyond the physical reality.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's amazing when you go there now, and even skeptical people who don't believe in many of the other visions that have been talked about, they either saw this and believe it, or their parents saw it, or other people they respect saw it. I've never heard anyone question that this took place. Yeah, so it's pretty astounding.
Well, speaking of visions and things, I wanted to cover one more aspect before we run out of time here. You had an experience at the Church of St. Mark.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about of what happened?
Well, I'll start just the day before that. I went to a monastery called Der Maharik. And Der Maharik is built around a house, what was a house, it's not there anymore, but it was built around a house that was believed to have been occupied by the Holy Family for 6 months. And it was considered Mary's favorite house. And in the middle of this house was a pharaonic stone that legend says Jesus slept on. And that stone is still there. And it's the altar for the entire monastery. So we were doing our filming, and one of the monks allowed me to go up to the, this is at the end of the trip, one of the monks allowed me to go up and touch the stone, so I did. And he said, you know, usually people pray for something they want when they touch this stone. So what do you want? And I thought about it for a minute, and I said, you know what, I want to know if the Holy Family Trail is for real. If the Holy Family actually took this trail and all the stories that I've heard and recorded took place. I just need a sign. And that was it. And I was done with the prayer, okay. So the next day, I photograph everything I can when I'm writing a book, because it helps me remember later when I'm writing what the place looked like. The next day, at night, probably 9 or 10 at night, I went to this area called the Church of St. Mark. And the Church of St. Mark is supposed to be built on the site where the angel appeared to Joseph and told him that King Herod had died and the Holy Family could now return to Israel. And I went there, I saw the church, and for hundreds of years, there have been stories about light coming down from the heavens right over this church. And there were some major instances where there was really a few years ago a pitch battle going on in this area, because it's an extremely fundamentalist area. And these lights started up, and the whole battle stopped. And people from all over Egypt came to see these lights and literally stop this battle that was taking place. So I set up my camera on top of a police car. The car's engine was off, and it's a digital camera. I didn't have a flash on, and I just hit my button. And what came out on the screen was the church steeple, part of an apartment building next to it, and a spray of light.
Right, this golden spray of light. It's actually on the slideshow at JesusInEgypt.com. It's the last photo.
Yeah,
I'm looking at it right now.
And that was just pouring down from the heavens. And so I turned around with this, you know, I had it on my digital screen, and I asked people as they walked by, what is this? And some got very excited, some were blasé, but they all said, we see that all the time. That's the light of Mary, they called it. It comes down over the church. And, it was an incredible moment for me. I got back to Cairo, and the bishop of Assut, Bishop Mikhael, found out about this photograph from some of the people that had seen it. And he sent monks to find me in Cairo, which was a long train trip for them. They found me in Cairo, and I gave them a big print. Because I took it to American University, to the graphic arts department, to have it analyzed. They couldn't figure out what it was. And the director of the department made a huge print for them and gave them the print. Okay, this is while I was writing the book. When I went back to make the film the next year, I went down to Assut, and they had turned the photo into a postcard and had sold 50,000 copies of it in a year. But it was really, it had written on the front in Arabic and English the whole story that I just told you. And, it's very impressive. You're all of a sudden run into your own postcard somewhere.
So that was confirmation for you when you were writing the book, and then later to go back and make the film. That's what you asked for, so your prayers were answered.
It was confirmation for me. That's exactly how I felt.
Well, some of the other parts of the film look at what's happening today, and the sort of the relationships that we've had, of course, with the United States overseas are sort of strained at this point. And one of the things that you found there was that you were, and you mentioned this before, you were received really well.
Yes.
And talk a little bit about how people who live in Egypt are looking at what's going on today from the reference point of, you know, what your search was.
Well, when I wrote the book, I went there just a few weeks after 9/11, and there was a lot of concern among my family, the book publisher, everyone else, that it wasn't a safe place to go. But I decided to go anyway because I had some experience with Egyptians and knew they were different from people in Iraq and, you know, in Afghanistan. So anyway, when I went there and I started traveling outside of the big city and into the country, into these little hamlets where people are far more fundamentalist. And I had very, very little trouble at all, mainly because of the fact that I was there working on a story about Jesus. And as I said earlier, Muslims and Christians have the same respect for Jesus. And that's one of the things that has actually kept the two religions from fighting in Egypt, is the fact that they both respect the Holy Family Trail, they respect these holy sites, and they respect Jesus. Now, I'll give you one story. I went to a little town called Deirut, which is a really just a hard scrabble little place. And I started walking down the street, just myself and my translator. And all of a sudden, people started coming out of their houses and following. And I kept walking down the street, trying to ignore them. But pretty soon, there were a lot of people behind me, and they didn't seem particularly happy. And one little boy ran ahead of us, and he went around the corner. And pretty soon, here comes this imam from the church, from the mosque. And he has several members of his congregation behind him, and he was a little guy, about like Yogi Berra, And he came right at the middle of the street and just stopped right in my chest. And he said, through translator, what are you doing here? You know, why is an American in Beirut? Which is an excellent question. And so I said to him, you know, I'm working on a book about the Holy Family in Egypt, and I understand that there is a well here, the well that was supposedly created by Jesus, and miracles occurred around the well. His attitude changed completely. He said, yes, there is. We built the mosque around the well. And let me take you and I'll show you. And he held my hand, took me back. Now, by now, the whole crowd has changed completely. They're very happy to see me. Takes me back to the mosque and told me the whole story about the well and about the history ever since then, how the Muslims decided to build around it because it was such a holy spot. And I found before that, and particularly after that, that to stay out of trouble in the Middle East, all I had to do was pretty much invoke the name of Jesus. And it explained everything for them, because they're very familiar with pilgrimages. And to them, I was on a pilgrimage.
Well, that's well, I bet you took a big breath of relief after that happened.
Oh, yeah.
I can imagine being in a spot like that and then having to, just tell the truth, and then hopefully people will take it easy with you. I haven't been in a jam like that myself, but I can imagine what that might be like. What do you think is will be in years from now the lasting significance of your book and the film Jesus the Lost Years for both Christians and non-Christians?
I feel like with both the book and the movie that I've opened a door to something that most people didn't know existed. I mean, the fact is, if you look at the Bible, there's only, you know, Jesus was with us for 33 years. There's only 3 of those 33 years covered in the Bible. So I think anyone who thinks about that realizes that there's 30 years that aren't covered in the Bible. There's 30 basically blacked out years in the life of Jesus. What was he doing? My goal with this isn't to try to rewrite the Bible or to even add anything to it. My goal is to take a look at what you could really consider to be, you know, the Bible is grade A information. This stuff is grade B information. But it helps fill in those years that we don't know anything about the life of Jesus. So that's really my goal with this, is to take a look at the traditions of the Middle East and show people that, hey, there's a whole bunch of stories out there about Jesus that are kind of neat to look at. That's it. It's a simple goal.
One of the other things that I've read a little bit about and heard about off of Jesus's life and talking about those 30 years was that, and this isn't mentioned in the Bible, maybe things were omitted, I mean, who knows. But what do you think about stories that he traveled to other parts of the world, like Egypt, possibly even the North American continent? Do you think that there's any evidence that's a good possibility that that actually happened in your mind?
Not in my mind, no. I mean, if I'm going to be a purist about this at all, then I kind of have to work with a time period that was actually bookended in the Bible. And that he went to Egypt is presented in the Bible. That he went to India is not presented in the Bible. It's possible that he did, but I just don't see any evidence of it, biblically. So I really wanted to stick with the Bible, with that
right
framework that they provided
for. Well, anyway, that's about all the time that we have. Paul, thanks so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you very much. And JesusInEgypt.com.
Right, JesusInEgypt.com. You want to find out more about Paul's story in the film. That's about a wrap for our show for today. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Join us again next week. And please tell your friends about where to find our program right here on 7thWaveNetwork.com.
And remember, you are the writer, producer, director, and star of your own movie that's called Your Life. So make it a blockbuster, and it'll be a classic. Until next time, I'm Randall Libero for Spirit of Film Conversations. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.